Thank you once again for tuning in to the Psychedelic Podcast. I'm your host, Tina Marie, and I'm here with your favorite panel of non-experts, Nico, Dawn, and Rob. Today we have RJ Jacobs with us, author and psychologist, and we're going to be discussing sociopathy. Is it sociopathy or sociopathy?
I think it could be pronounced either way. I think some people say sociopathy.
Yeah. That's even more sophisticated.
RJ, how's everything been going since our initial interview?
Still busy, working, doing my regular stuff, trying to write a third book right now that's going to come out maybe next year. We'll see. I'm in the first draft stages of it, so that's kind of my focus right now.
Awesome. We all have some burning questions for you. I see you over there, Rob. But if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you this. In your book, Somewhere in the Dark, the main character, Jesse, is an obsessed fan and a sociopath. Would you define her as a protagonist or an antagonist?
Oh, great question. So I actually wouldn't define her as a sociopath. I think that she's misperceived as that, and people treat her like that. I think that she actually is sort of misunderstood, and as the story goes on, her character is more and more revealed. I guess I would have to say that she's a flawed protagonist. In some ways, I think that that's part of what makes for a really interesting main character, is that they're not just completely spotless and perfect about everything, but that they have some flaws and things about them that maybe people consider to be liabilities, but that end up being strengths in the end.
Oh, that's nice. Rob?
Does she have bipolar disorder, the main character?
The main character in the first book actually has bipolar disorder. In that book, And Then You Were Gone, I wanted to sort of explore that in a manic state, people are able to sort of do things that they wouldn't normally be able to do. My character needs to be able to do those things to sort of solve the mystery as the story goes on. She stays awake for an extended period of time, has a flight of ideas, a lot of creativity. That's instrumental in the climax of that book.
Riding off those bipolar highs and lows, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Dawn, do you have any burning questions?
I do. I'm really curious about your take on obsession versus addiction, because I know that you can be...
I love you, Dawn.
I love you.
Thanks, Nick.
How is it that we have the same question?
I love you guys. We're like all in the same brainwave. What would you say is the difference or similarity between obsession and addiction from your professional standpoint?
They actually have a lot of similarities. So I see why you're asking that question. You can look at obsession sort of in the model of addiction. There's a sort of emptiness and a preoccupation with doing certain things. But obsession really is a lot more broad. It can be focused on a lot of different things. One thing that fascinates people about obsession is that a lot of times when people are obsessed with something, they're usually otherwise high-functioning people, but they really sort of are focused on their obsessions. Their obsessions sort of get in the way. In sort of the OCD model of obsession and compulsion, you can look at obsession as a kind of broken strategy for managing anxiety, where the person has the sort of sense that if only they performed the compulsion associated with the obsession, it would relieve their anxiety. But the problem, of course, is that it just kind of keeps refilling. In that way, it is sort of like an addiction.
I was out walking my dog, and one of our neighbors was like, my daughter is obsessed with huskies. We couldn't say, oh, my daughter is addicted to huskies, but we could say, oh, my daughter is obsessed with huskies.
I think that actually brings up a really good point. One of the great things that's happened in mental health in the last 20 years is that it's been destigmatized and people are much more comfortable talking about mental health issues and struggles and things that they're going through. One problem that I think is associated with that is that people can tend to over-identify with certain diagnoses. And so a lot of times people will say, I'm obsessed with something, when really what they mean is I kind of have a strong preference about it. It's not really a true obsession. And I hear this all the time when people say, I'm a little OCD about this or that, or they say, oh, that's my PTSD. And really, they don't have a sense of the scale. It frustrates people who have diagnoses that relate to those things because Absolutely. They have a sense like, if only you knew, you wouldn't be mischaracterizing it. it's interesting. Those words have kind of made their way into the common vocabulary, but I think a lot of times they're misused.
So a hoarder wouldn't be categorized as a sociopath. They just have some sort of developmental trauma that maybe they lost something that was very dear to their heart and valuable as a child. They want to keep everything that they get so they don't ever have to lose anything that could potentially be valuable to them again. And I think it's taken to extremes like hoarding paper in cardboard boxes and trash and rat feces. But back to the addiction part, is it safe to say that different forms of highs, anything that's fleeting, makes them feel some sort of rush or some sort of danger might interest them? Riding roller coasters, stealing.
Let me answer your question in a really complicated way. So when it comes to people with sociopathy or antisocial personality disorder, there actually is a lot of evidence that they're very sensation seeking. They take a lot of risks, have a difficult time tolerating boredom, engage in a lot of dangerous activity. It's probably to try to stimulate a part of their brain that is understimulated. There's a lot of speculation about what that's about, but there is a lot of sensation-seeking behavior that dates back to childhood. A lot of times, there's a developmental component to it as well. When it comes to obsessive-compulsive disorder, it's sort of a contrast in that it's actually more like the reverse. Typically, anxiety builds up, and the person who's the patient has a sense that it will continue building indefinitely. When they perform the compulsive behavior, that anxiety abates, at least temporarily. To go back to psychology 101 for a second, anytime you take away an aversive stimulus, that's essentially negative reinforcement, right? Negative meaning taking away, reinforcement meaning you're making the behavior more likely to recur. In a sense, you're not really stimulating the person with a high when they perform the behavior. You're taking away, in this case, anxiety that is unpleasurable.
That's really interesting. Thank you. In our last episode that we did on psychopaths, we learned that the amygdala of a psychopath is 18% smaller than the average human being. Do you think sociopaths also have part of their brain that's not fully developed? Are they born that way? What's the major difference between a psychopath and a sociopath?
These are great questions. Let me just start by kind of taking them in their subparts. The difference between a psychopath and a sociopath is really no difference. It's sort of similar vocabulary, almost like in the difference between a lawyer and an attorney. It almost kind of depends a little bit on the context of the person who's talking about it. Actually, sociopath, psychopath, and antisocial personality disorder generally refer to the same thing. Psychopath is the older term. Classification and diagnosis has evolved over the course of the history of psychology. We are now on the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual Part 5 revised. Not to be too long-winded about it, it's essentially talking about the same thing. There are structural changes in the brain or structural differences in that population, and people can only really speculate about why that is. Probably explains some of that sensation-seeking behavior.
No real conclusive way to determine if somebody's a psychopath, a sociopath, or has anti-personality disorder, is what I'm hearing. Is there some sort of scan or test that can be done, kind of like with depression, where not as many parts of your brain lights up? Is there a certain terminology for the scientific way to study that?
That a little bit gets into neuroscience, which kind of isn't my area of expertise, and I wouldn't claim that it is, but
I just thought you knew everything, man.
A lot of diagnoses are made based on behavior. It's very rare that someone with antisocial personality disorder would seek out treatment. Usually it's sort of the people around them who would want some help. It's their own personality, so they don't have a sense that there's anything particularly wrong. They are just who they are. Their willingness to be tested probably would be low. They wouldn't show up and say, hey, I'd like to be evaluated for this in the way that someone would for anxiety or depression. You kind of can see a pattern of behavior reported by other people that would provide enough evidence to make a diagnosis. And certain populations of people, like in prison, for example, have a much vaster proportion proportion of people with that diagnosis. So you can kind of look back over the history of their development and see if it would support a diagnosis.
I'd like to circle back to obsession for a minute, because I'm curious about, you know, you're saying people, whether or not they're likely to come in to be evaluated or want to seek help. And sometimes you can't tell that you have a problem. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering from your perspective, how someone can know if they are having obsessive tendencies and when they should seek help or what they can do, how to recognize one is becoming obsessed in an unhealthy way.
That's a great question. So one of the characteristics of OCD is that often the person does have a sense that the thought content of their obsessions is generated by their own mind. This is not really the stuff of daily worries. There's a part of them that knows it's irrational. And one of the mysterious parts about it is that despite knowing it's irrational, they find that they continue to think about it anyway. So, for example, somebody might have a preoccupation with burning down their house, and they know pretty well that they have not left their stove on. There's no real reason to believe that they have. They may have already checked it several times, and yet they're troubled by that thought anyway. Usually there is a sort of metacognition part of that that lets them kind of have that awareness about their own thoughts. The second part of your question was about treatment. You know, unfortunately, one of the corollaries with OCD is a lot of marital distress. Oftentimes, it's their spouse or their partner who encourages them to come in and get treatment or is getting treatment themselves because they're so frustrated by the pattern.
Is that like when women overclean that OCD within the marriage?
Sure, that would be a great example of it. I mean, you can imagine if your partner spent hours and hours every day performing a certain behavior, they'd be pretty checked out on their relationship. You might feel kind of lonely. It might be frustrating. Sometimes people with obsessive and compulsive behaviors kind of can't seem to grasp the big picture and may like make their spouse late for something or be late for work. And those sorts of things accumulate over time and can strain a relationship.
Nico, what do you have to say about this?
My mind's just going all over the place. Like, I have so many questions. How did you get your first novel published, and what was that kind of process all about?
Oh, man. Nico, it was an adventure. I'll say that. I didn't have hardly any experience. So I was really kind of starting at square one and just trying to figure it out as I went along. I met a couple of really excellent people who were already established in publishing who gave me some advice along the way, but pretty much I had to check my ego at the door and kind of keep submitting my manuscript to anybody who would take a look at it. And the first step really to get published in fiction is you have to have an agent. So I really lucked out with a really excellent agent who gave me some guidance about how to make the manuscript better.
And so you went through a publishing company. You didn't self-publish.
Yeah, it's a traditionally published like publishing company. So then my agent had some things that she wanted me to do to fix up the book. She pitched it around, and then I signed a contract with a publisher called Crooked Lane, who's been excellent.
Cool. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Yeah, man.
Or I guess thank you for sharing that with us. We're all in this conversation, and this is a podcast.
RJ, about your book publishing, you were talking about checking your ego at the door and continuing to submit your letters. How many rejections did you get?
I lost count, Dawn.
Really?
Love the honesty.
I have several questions back to back about book writing. Y'all are hearing it here first. I'm writing a book, and so I have some burning questions. Hey. I'm so thrilled to be talking to not only a New York Times bestselling author, but someone who has written multiple books. It's an honor. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. A little background about me. I used to be in journalism. I had a minor in professional writing, and then I became a journalist. So I got a lot of practice writing under pressure because we had deadlines and we had to make print times. And then later on, it was about online sourcing material and getting clicks and stuff. So I was under a lot of pressure. And because of that, I did a ton of writing in a short amount of time. But I find that when I'm writing on my own, I don't have the same pressure. It's more like I'm writing for enjoyment, but if I get bored, I step away from it. Maybe a day or two or a few weeks go by and I've not written anything. So can you talk a little bit about your creative process and how you stayed on top of it enough to be on your third book now?
That's actually a question that a lot of authors face, about how to be disciplined and make sure that they're getting their own stuff done, because it's a pretty solitary pursuit and really you're only accountable to yourself. A couple of years ago, I was sitting in an audience watching a panel of different writers talk about the same problem, and they each had a different metric for how they could measure that they had gotten stuff done that day. One person said that she did it by time. She had a certain hour that she would try and be productive. And the next writer said, you know, I have to have a word count as my measure. If I just went by time, I would waste my time. So I have to make sure that I get a certain number of words done. I guess I would think to encourage you to figure out, maybe with a little experimentation, what works best for you.
Rob, go ahead.
What is the name of your third book going to be, if you've decided yet?
Actually, the title is something that I have a working title right now. But one thing that I've kind of gotten used to in publishing is just how much stuff changes from the time that you submit a first draft to the time it's on a bookshelf. So the title is in my head. It's called The Promise of Fear. But I don't know if that'll be the title when it comes out.
I think that sounds really cool. The Promise of Fear.
That's a very hard-hitting title. I like that.
What's really cool about RJ is that, Rob, you earlier brought up, his first book is about a girl with bipolar disorder. He's a psychologist, and he writes books on these mental illnesses that he gets to see every day in the workplace. And RJ, I know that you wanted to talk a little bit about how sociopaths is different in a psychotherapy type of setting versus fiction.
There's a couple of things I can talk about with that. I think the thing that kind of gets the most confused between a clinical setting and when you're reading fiction is about what constitutes obsession. And I think to just say it simply, in fiction, I think obsession is often used to provide the motivation. It seems like it sort of supplies the story. A character will be, you know, quote unquote, obsessed with something and will pursue it. And that will be part of their motivation. But in clinical terms, usually obsession is something that people operate despite. It gets in their way. It's usually an impediment, not what they're trying to get done. It's usually a distractor.
I have to ask this. There are a lot of films and TV shows that depict sociopaths, but if you had to pick one, what would be the closest to the reality of what you consider a sociopath to be?
Man, that is a great question. I wish I watched more TV. I feel like I'm missing out on a big part of the culture. I wish I had somebody that came to mind, a character that came to mind. A lot of times I think they're portrayed as being sort of evil. And I think that that could be the case to a degree. Usually they're described as being somebody who is absent. They're missing something. And that something is sort of a sense of morality. I think sometimes not necessarily setting out to perform evil acts, but without a sense of guiding morality, you combine that with someone who is sensation seeking or somebody who takes on dangerous or risky behaviors. I think that that combination of things kind of supplies a lot of the context for sociopathy.
Yes, Rob.
So I know that there can be extremely covert sociopaths and very overt sociopaths. Do you think there's any middle ground?
I think kind of the best answer to your question is, what about a person with the diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder would make them more likely to engage in criminal behavior? And there's not a clear answer on that. But getting close to it is their level of intellectual functioning. So how smart they are actually is a pretty good predictor. If you have a high level of intellectual functioning, you're less likely to become somebody who engages in a lot of criminal behavior because you have all sorts of other opportunities or ways to kind of go about your life. But without seeing those possibilities, yeah, I think it's more likely you would kind of engage in some risk-taking stuff.
Nico and Dawn, when we did psychopathy, you had some really interesting perspectives on how you feel about psychopaths. Now that RJ is telling us from a doctor's standpoint that psychopathy is basically the same as sociopathy and antisocial personality disorder, have your opinions changed? And if not, why?
My opinions have not changed for the main reason that it's from the DSM-5 that I pulled my connotation or my idea of what a psychopath is. And when I talk about psychopaths, we were talking about individuals having psychopathic traits like grandiose sense of self and things like that. But what we determined was that there's a difference between somebody who shows these traits and somebody who actually is a psychopath, right? And I think what RJ did was reinforce that information.
Dawn, what about you?
I don't think that my opinion or perspective has changed a whole lot, but I thought it was pretty interesting to keep thinking about the fact that these people don't feel like they're doing anything wrong, but it's usually the people around them that are having a hard time coping with them that then seek out help. And then as a result, those people end up seeking help or at least being somewhat aware of the fact that they're having a problem. I wonder, though, about people that don't have many people around them, because we talked in our psychopath episode about people growing up in families that are distorted, inflicting this kind of trauma on these people as children. They don't have a healthy environment to say, hey, what you're doing isn't right, or what you're doing is hurting people. And so they have more ability to act out unhinged and without any type of control. So it actually, like Nico said, I think it reinforces my vision or my interpretation from at least a spiritual standpoint when we talk about something missing. And we talked about these people being a mirror of our society to show us the contrast and what we do want to encourage in our children and things like that. You, RJ, as a parent, we've talked a few times on our show about how when we become parents, our perspective changes on a lot of different things.
I'd love to say that I have some ability to apply those ideas constantly, but it's really difficult. I'll say that one thing that I think is sort of a difference there is that a lot of clinical work is focused on the treatment of a problem. But I think the other side of that is not about just identifying problems, but figuring out proactive ways to live in a healthy way. And I think that sort of the circumstances of what makes for a healthy lifestyle and understanding that maybe helps me to work on creating a healthier environment for my kids.
So being aware of operant and classical conditioning and all of that, I'm definitely projecting right now because I've caught myself doing it to my fiance and treating her in a way where I was trying to yield a result out of her. So conditioning the environment to result in a way that I wanted to, right? So I'm still having internal ethical issues about catching myself doing that to my fiance. But what I wonder is that something that we can do to our kids, is teach them in some kind of classical operant conditioning to yield results for themselves? Is it unhealthy for us to do that to our children?
I think the best way I can answer your question is that a lot of times, the way that I see it most often is that a lot of times people have a sense if they're being manipulated, they don't want to reinforce a behavior. And so they'll resist playing into that manipulation. What I try to tell people is that even if they have a sense that someone is manipulating them, for example, their kid, it doesn't mean that they don't really need what they're asking for. Basically, just because you're asking for something in a really manipulative or annoying way doesn't mean that it's not a real need. And I think that's kind of important to keep in mind when you're parenting.
RJ, have you ever dealt with a sociopath that did know they were a sociopath and came seeking for help, or is that completely not a thing?
Probably not in my setting. You know, I've worked in an outpatient psychology setting, basically a private practice. for the last dozen years. And before that, I worked on a college campus. Neither one of those settings really lends itself to a lot of antisocial personality disorder. The notion of psychology and counseling is one where the old joke is, how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? One, but the bulb has to really want to change. Most of the time, people with the diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder wouldn't be motivated that way.
Well, when it comes to being a doctor and everything that you have learned, you've said psychopath, sociopath, and antisocial personality disorder is essentially the same thing. Does that mean that antisocial personality disorder is the newest terminology?
Yeah, I think people use those terms sort of interchangeably. I would have to look, but I believe that it is the newest term. I think psychopath is the oldest, and I think sociopath came after that.
Oh, okay. Rob?
Do you think that it's universally fair to say that sociopaths, psychopaths, APD-traited people like to blend in with their appearance as to not be suspected or being singled out as what they know they truly are? And so they don't act erratic and usually dress like everybody else, right? Like, they're not wearing the all black trench coat.
Rob, I don't have a lot of data on that, but I think that if I was in that position, I probably wouldn't announce it.
Right.
That would be the smart thing to do.
I am going to go a little off topic because it is a motif that I've seen in writing, as well as a motif that I've seen amongst shows. I first saw it in the comic Moon Knight, a Marvel character. You'll see it in Deadpool. And then there was a show on FX called Legion where you see it. And there's other places that you can see the motif. And that is, there's a supposed sane man in a insane asylum, but it's easier to prove that this person is insane than to prove that this person is sane. That's why you'll see quote unquote sane people in a insane asylum. Is there a way to prove that you are a sane person?
One thing that I'll say about inpatient psychiatric facilities is that for the most part, they're really about stabilization. I mean, most of the time people are there for a very limited amount of time, and it's about trying to make sure that they're safe and not in any danger of harming themselves or somebody else. Usually it's about trying to stabilize. Most of the time people want out. They don't want to stay there for a terribly long time. As you can imagine, it's not a very fun place to be, and it's expensive to be there. The hospital themselves has to sort of figure out a way to make sure that the patient is safe and move them back into their family and community.
So I would like to move the conversation forward a little bit. We talk a lot about social issues in the world that we live in, that our generation is creating today. And for your professional standpoint, where would you like to see mental health go in the future? Where do you think the gaps are, and what can we improve going forward? Like, if you were completely in charge of mental health, where would you want to take it next?
What a great question. You know, I'll tell you two different things that kind of come to mind. One is, I think that mental health is trending into more of an integrative model. So I think that you're looking at teams of helpers who are looking at things from a social work position, a mental health position, maybe a physician, sort of a team of people who are looking at the whole individual. So I think mental health will continue to move in as part of a larger healthcare integrative model. Just in terms of what I think the tasks are for mental health integrating into sort of its best iteration of being helpful, I think that probably seeing the whole individual, seeing how one part of a person's life informs another. A lot of it is about lifestyle, diet, exercise, sleep. I think looking at the factors and the circumstances of a person's life and various perspectives around that, I think that's probably the future.
As a follow-up to that, what I'm hearing you're saying is more of a holistic approach towards mental health and viewing the whole person in their life. I was recently in therapy a little while ago, if you're familiar with our show, you know that I'm a very spiritual person, and I like to talk a lot about how energy is affecting me, whether it's the rotation of the planets or someone around me that's, or, you know, stress in my environment or something. I take that stuff very seriously, but my psychiatrist was set on dismissing that. And yet I've heard of therapists who don't dismiss, who actually try to incorporate or at least view that perspective. And if that is a part of a person, do you think that there is a place in mental health's future for a holistic diagnosis that also includes spiritual health?
I think that whatever the person's resources are important to recognize, and I think should be drawn upon. One of the limitations of psychology is that as a science, psychology wants to be empirical, and that means collect data, do studies, have efficacy for treatments that they can prescribe. And some of what you're talking about, energy and about spirituality, is very difficult to quantify. I think that it may seem like it's coming from a different place than the science of psychology. But I think to not recognize it would be a big mistake, especially if it's really important to the patient.
Don likes to talk about the heart chakra and how it allows us to connect with everything around us. Do you think there is a missing link, something that is missing in their soul? And I know we have to further the study in the mental health field, in the medical field. It's kind of developed and learned through environment and trauma and stuff like that. But once they do hit that point where it's set in stone and they have these traits, defects, or disorders, do you think there is a way to rectify it?
Rob, that's a good question, and it's a little bit difficult to answer. One thing I'll tell you about personality disorders is that they're different from other kinds of disorders. They're really sort of woven into the DNA of the person. You contrast that with, say, a patient who is depressed. That depression may come or go at different levels throughout their life. It may be present as a function of stress or after a significant event in their life. But when a person has a personality disorder, it's really part of who they are. In some ways, that's sort of discouraging when it comes to treatment. But again, you're not looking at people who are really motivated for treatment to change their own personality.
In terms of recognizing the habits and characteristics, I was reading they have really intense grooming rituals. So they have like these rigorous sessions in the morning. They take that seriously to like a deeper emotional level, since they can be borderline narcissistic. And so they're very self-centered and only really have the capacity to care about themselves. Do you know any specific ones?
I unfortunately don't know a ton about that. I can say a couple of things. One is that the behavioral observations about risk-taking, having a difficult time tolerating boredom, and maybe engaging in some dangerous or criminal behavior would probably be the best way to identify somebody with that diagnosis. I will say that a lot of times that disorder shows up in childhood. There's some behavioral evidence of it in adolescence, and the two things that are most predictive of it developing into an adult disorder, and these may seem kind of strange or disparate concepts, but one is cruelty to animals, and the other one is starting fires.
And then there was urinating their bed.
Beyond age five.
Cruelty to animals, that's a really bad one. I'm so confused on what I read online, because I'm obviously not a psychologist myself. I'm confused on a lot of articles online of why psychopaths are apparently born that way, and it has to do with their amygdala. Like, a lot of articles say that sociopaths are created. I mean, that's a big difference. If someone with a smaller amygdala and someone has been through some kind of traumatic events in their life that made them become the way they are in a bad way. So I don't really understand why they're the same. I still don't get it.
Tina, I think that's a good question. The confusion that you have about that is shared with a lot of people in social science. That classic nature versus nurture debate is sort of the fodder for a lot of research and discussion. Identifying the factors that sort of go into creating a problem in adulthood. one model that merges those two things is that a person could perhaps be born with a proclivity or a specific disposition, and then the circumstances could ignite the disposition into a larger problem.
I just think it's interesting, and I want your take on this, RJ, being late for any sort of appointment, being late for work. Sociopaths don't stress out where it's warranted or in very uncomfortable situations like most people do. Like Tina said, I was kind of on the same track as her with what she said. I've also read sociopaths don't feel anything at all unless it's for their own self-gain or self-benefit.
I sort of feel like sociopaths, like he said, are on a different spectrum, like can be a lower level person with antisocial personality disorder, or like they can be very intelligent or not so intelligent and end up engaging in criminal behavior instead. And a lot of people with APD probably are really high up in certain types of businesses and maybe even doctors, not you, RJ, but I feel like a lot of them could definitely be psychologists or psychiatrists.
Politics, definitely. A normal person with morals and values and empathy and compassion can't be a politician. That's why they are all in the positions that they are, because they don't have morals. They're the only types of people that could possibly fit into that realm. You definitely have to have some sociopathic tendencies in you. You'd F over a lot of people to get that kind of power.
Rob, I'm
well,
right.
Yeah, Nico, go ahead.
Rob, I completely disagree with you, man. I feel like that's a way to reframe a person's personality. You say you have to be evil. I say flexible. You say they have to have these lack of ethics, this lack of morals. I think it's the opposite. I think it's a flexible sense of morals and ethics, and just one that's different than yours. But we're kind of going off track. That's such a fun conversation.
Unless you got to flex it, though, to get there. You know I'm a conspiracist. Don't be surprised.
I'm not going to disagree and say you have to be corrupt. Corrupt, such a negative connotation to it, but yeah, to create a euphemism instead of saying corrupt, you could say you have to please a lot of different people with a lot of different contexts. You have to please, proverbially speaking, Yankees fans and Red Sox fans. And the Red Sox fans is like, this guy doesn't like me because he's a Yankees fan, right? Yeah. Like, that's why I think that's a very metaphorical example, but I think we're going off topic. I think Dawn's back on topic.
She is, but dude, that was a good point.
No, I'm going to jump right in here on this discourse. I'm going to jump right in. I'm going to bring it together because I actually agree with both of you on the example of Ron Paul running for president, because Ron Paul was a pure individual who wanted the best for everyone, who was a nice guy. Everyone agreed, you know, that he was a family doctor. He was an OB. He delivered babies. That was his main profession. He did have a political career, but he obviously didn't make it as president, even though he had a really strong following. So why was he not able to get the following that he would need from the grassroots to propel him to the top if he was such a good person and was so able to articulate himself and answer his questions succinctly and under the desired time in every debate possible? You would think that based on those metrics that he would be able to become president. But as Nico is saying, he didn't have flexible morals. And as you were saying, Rob, he was not evil enough. So I think you're both right.
Well,
RJ, what do you think about that?
The election is rigged.
Wait, Rob.
Sorry, RJ.
I wouldn't know how to even begin to answer the question exactly. I'm reluctant to say all or none on just about anything. And so I'm sure that there are some people who are in politics who are in it for totally the right reasons. I worry more about why anybody would want to get into politics now, because it seems so difficult and challenging. So it seems like you'd be paying a pretty big price to kind of get into the field.
Yeah. You just said you're paying a pretty big price to get into the field. So let's circle back to your book. That was a lot of time that you put into both of those books. Can you refresh everybody's minds on how long it took you to write the second book?
It's kind of a nonlinear process. It took me about 6 months to write a first draft, but that first draft didn't really resemble the book that came out of it. So probably I had a draft that my agent could shop around after about a year. They say that it takes about a year to write a book, a year to edit, and then about another year for it to be published. I think that's probably pretty accurate. People find different inspiration points. I've heard some people say that they have the title in mind and that it all kind of comes from there. I've seen people essentially write one story, get pretty near to the end of it, and then have to kind of go back and rewrite major parts of it. A lot changes. Covers change. The titles get tweaked. Release dates get pushed back. The one thing you really have to be is flexible.
Hasn't your cover changed twice for Somewhere in the Dark?
The cover changed one time.
Once.
Yeah.
I love the red and black.
Thanks. The red and black was the original cover. At some point, the title was in yellow, but there was actually a book that came out about a year ago with a very similar title. The cover looked somewhat similar. My agent said that she thought it could be confusing or that people could think that they had already read that book. And so to avoid that confusion, we changed it back to red. I actually really like the red. I'm happy with how it's going to come out.
I think it's really interesting that he's a psychologist, right? He writes about fictional stories. He's got this full understanding of these types of people and that he's created fictional novels about it.
Is there a shared plot, a shared motif other than mental issues in these stories?
The genre is actually called psychological suspense, and it's sort of the mystery genre. I guess the shared motif is that there's actually somewhat predictable sequence of things that have to happen in that genre. They're both set in Nashville. I actually haven't really set out to write about a lot of mental health issues, but I guess they say write what you know. That's probably the area that I have the most experience with. And so I think probably it adds to some richness of character.
Edgar Allan Poe was very well known to be the father of the detective fiction, as well as creating
everything.
That's two in a row.
I'm just kidding.
Well, I'm sorry. Edgar Allan Poe's my boy. He's my favorite.
The father of all.
He's worth noting. Yes. So he was the father of the detective genre and also the father of the psychological suspense, right? But that's very much what the Telltale Heart, Cask of Amontillado, that's what they all were. My question to you is, what is your inspiration to write? Where do you draw your inspiration that made you decide, I think I want to put together a book like this?
That is a good question, Nico, because last interview, RJ had all of that and we had to cut it out because the audio was terrible. So RJ, I am excited for you to be able to say this finally.
They say that this could be the golden age of mysteries and suspense books because there are so many great authors that are coming out with books right now. So there actually are a ton of contemporary authors that are very inspiring. My friend Lane Fargo has a book that's coming out. Her first book was called Temper. It's amazing. Now that I'm sort of on the spot, my head's going blank. There's an author in town named J.T. Ellison, and she writes fantastic books. In some ways, it's sort of inspiring to watch the contemporary authors do it even more than the historical authors because they're writing about the cultural context that we're in now.
It's cool that a lot of the books on the New York Times bestseller are in that genre.
So, RJ, my question for you then is, do you draw inspiration for your characters from patients that you've had or people that you've come across in your work? Because I noticed in some of your writing, you go into a lot of detail about specific actions and behaviors that I think you may have more insight into than the average person. And that makes the character very interesting because we're seeing through the eyes of a person who does not behave the same way that we do. Do you gain your inspiration from some of your patients?
I've actually been asked that question a number of times. And I have to say, every now and then, I'll hear a little bit of a story that will stick with me, or there'll be a theme that will stick with me, but actually they're very separate. I'd love to be able to tell a great story about how they overlap or I draw so much inspiration, but the tasks are just so different. obviously when I'm at work, there's a lot of face-to-face contact, and it's really kind of rejuvenating to start to write fiction in the evenings and kind of get away kind of into my own private space. So it feels like two really completely different worlds.
So you guys did not see RJ's fantabulous bookshelves. I did on accident. It was by pure accident. And he has literally, I would say, like 1,000 books in that room, right, RJ?
I haven't counted them all, but they seem like they keep stacking up.
What's your favorite type of book? What's your favorite genre?
I'm trying to read more books right now in the genre that I write in. So mystery and psychological suspense. The genre that's referred to as literary fiction is focused on kind of describing the real world. I like contemporary literary fiction a lot.
Yes, Rob.
So back in the day, growing up, I know that there was a lot more milder psychological thrillers, mystery novels, like Nancy Drew and stuff like that. The Boxcar Children. I don't know if you've heard of that. But do you think there's any correlation to the increase in sociopaths with the more graphic novels coming out within that genre nowadays?
Gosh, I don't know. Not to sound like a total equivocal psychologist, but a correlation could go both ways, right? So correlation's different than causation. If you're not careful, you might make it sound like the novels are making people sociopaths.
Yeah.
But it could be that there's just more crime.
It's definitely worth assessing.
Oh, you did a Nick out.
But yeah, maybe it's just more media. Maybe there's just more coverage on the incidences that are
RJ happening. Has to be neutral.
What I like about you, RJ, is that you're so empirical. We delve deep into our opinions and how, and sometimes they don't come with a lot of scientific backing or anything like that. We're just going into our opinions and our perspective. And you're just like, you know, I can't really assess that. I need to be more like that sometimes.
This is pretty crazy. We actually hit number 2 in Argentina, of all places, yesterday for philosophy. And we hit top 100 in America for society and culture and philosophy in the past 2 days.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so this is going to get heard by everyone. Everybody, if you have a seriously burning question, opinion, or question about his book, you should go in the order of Nico, Don, Rob.
I'm just very happy that this conversation was had, this panel was had, because we got to kind of pick the brain of not only a psychologist, definitely a professional in the topics of what we speak about, but also because you're an author, there's a few of us who are trying to get into that kind of field and further that. So this, it felt like a really awesome time to kill two birds with one stone. So thank you, RJ, for being so flexible with us while we changed up that panel on you. We greatly appreciate you being here. It was a lot of fun having this discussion.
Well, I really appreciate you guys having me on anytime. My pleasure.
Don?
RJ, I want to piggyback off what Nico said and appreciate you for coming onto our show and answering our questions, because I know that a lot of our listeners tend to have similar questions. And I think that it's been really interesting listening to you take a very complicated topic and make it relatable for us in terms of what we see in the world and how we can categorize it better, because like you said, mental health is becoming more of a mainstream topic now. And that's something that I think us here on the Psychedelic Podcast, we try to do. We try to bring topics out that are tough to discuss, but important for our generation to move forward. So I think that you're doing really great and diverse work in terms of not only helping people personally do this, but also shedding light as an author on what that means in society. So I really appreciate you answering all of our very difficult questions.
Well, I'm sure RJ has to hear all kinds of questions all the time from his clients.
I just want to triple piggyback off of that one with the praise for RJ. RJ, thank you so much for coming on, man. You are an awesome dude, I can tell. You're an awesome speaker. I admire you a lot. And I feel like we kind of have some closure on the three topics of narcissism, sociopaths, and psychopaths. But you helped us close that chapter. within our podcast, although it's going to definitely come up in references in the future. I feel like you wrapped all that up stupendously for us, and I want to thank you for that. And I can't wait to read your new book that's coming out. And I'm definitely going to buy the first book as soon as possible.
Thanks a lot, Rob. It was my pleasure. Anytime.
RJ, to quadruple piggyback off of that. Thank you, as always. Somewhere in the Dark will be released on August 11th of 2020. That's this year, you guys. Leo season. And all of RJ's links will be in our episode description, so you can check him out. And go ahead and follow him on Instagram or his Facebook page, which will also be in the description. And RJ, do you have any final thoughts or perspectives on what you'd like to share with our audience?
I'm just really glad you guys had me on. Thanks so much for the conversation. I really enjoyed it. Hopefully our paths will cross again soon.
I'm sure they will.
Yeah. Thank you. Have a great rest of the weekend, guys.
You have an awesome life.